Welcome to Zero Knowledge. I'm your host, Anna Rose. In this podcast, we will be exploring the latest in zero knowledge research and the decentralized web, as well as new paradigms that promise to change the way we interact and transact online. This week, guest co-host Brendan and I interview Ben Fish from Espresso Systems. We dive into the world of L2 sequencing, shared sequencing, MEV in the new system, the marketplace Espresso is building, and so much more. Quick disclosure, I'm an investor in Espresso Systems through ZKV, and ZKV is also exploring working with the system. And yet, I feel I had so much to learn from this interview about what they're building and how different actors can get involved in it. Hope this helps to shed a little bit of light on the shared sequencing concept for you too. Now, before we kick off, I just want to let you know about an upcoming hackathon we are getting very excited about. ZK Hack Krakow is now set to happen from May 17th to 19th in Krakow. In the spirit of ZK Hack Lisbon and ZK Hack Istanbul, we will be hosting hackers from all over the world to join us for a weekend of building and experimenting with ZK Tech. We already have some amazing sponsors confirmed, like Mina, O1 Labs, Polygon, Aleph Zero, Scroll, Avail, Nethermind, and more. If you're interested in participating, apply as a hacker. There will be prizes and bounties to be won, new friends and collaborators to meet, and great workshops to get you up to date on ZK tooling. Hope to see you there. I've added the link in the show notes, and you can also visit zkhackkrakow.com to learn more. Now, Tanya will share a little bit about this week's sponsors.
Launching soon, Nemada is a proof-of-stake L1 blockchain focused on multi-chain asset-agnostic privacy via a unified set. Nemada is natively interoperable with fast finality chains via IBC and with Ethereum using a trust-minimized bridge. Any compatible assets from these ecosystems, whether fungible or non-fungible, can join Nemada's unified shielded set, effectively erasing the fragmentation of privacy sets that has limited multi-chain privacy guarantees in the past. By remaining within the shielded set, users can utilize shielded actions to engage privately with applications on various chains, including Ethereum, Osmosis, and Celestia, that are not natively private. Nemada's unique incentivization is embodied in its shielded set rewards. These rewards function as a bootstrapping tool, rewarding multi-chain users who enhance the overall privacy of Nemada participants. Follow Nemada on Twitter, @Nemada, for more information, and join the community on Discord, discord.gg/Nemada. Aleo is a new Layer 1 blockchain that achieves the programmability of Ethereum, the privacy of Zcash, and the scalability of a rollup. Driven by a mission for a truly secure internet, Aleo has interwoven zero-knowledge proofs into every facet of their stack, resulting in a vertically integrated Layer 1 blockchain that's unparalleled in its approach. Aleo is ZK by design. Dive into their programming language Leo and see what permissionless development looks like, offering boundless opportunities for developers and innovators to build ZK apps. This is an invitation to be part of a transformational ZK journey. Dive deeper and discover more about Aleo at aleo.org. And now, here's our episode.
Today, we are here with Ben Fish, co-founder and CEO of Espresso Systems. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. It's good to be back, Anna.
And we have Brendan today as the guest co-host. Welcome, Brendan.
Thanks, Anna.
So, Ben, I was looking back at our last episode. It was over 2 years ago that you came on the show and you did introduce Espresso. But what we talked about back then and the product and everything has changed so much. I'm very excited to get a chance to kind of catch up and learn about what's changed, what's happening. I also am very excited to get a chance to dive into shared sequencers. This is like something that I think Tarun and I, especially those episodes, we've mentioned it a bunch of times, but we've never actually covered it on the show.
Yeah, let's go.
So the first part, I really do want to understand the shift from what we talked about last time to working on shared sequencers. Like, what was it in your journey kind of with this project that caused that pivot?
When we started out working on Espresso Systems, we were building a privacy product, so it was quite different. We started out with the system that we were developing was called CAPE, Configurable Asset Privacy, and it was all about balancing, you know, the need for regulatory oversight and disclosures with the need for privacy. And so that was what CAPE was about. And we found that it was a compelling product, but it was very difficult to find product market fit, at least at the time. I don't know if the times have shifted by now, but we found it to be quite difficult. And at the same time as we were working on on this privacy product, we were also building infrastructure that would increase efficiency. And Acape was actually supposed to be deployed as a layer two application. So we were getting familiar with the layer two landscape and what it, you know, meant to run applications on the layer two. And something that was very top of mind for us was the fact that if we ran Cape as a payment platform on top of other layer twos, it would be quite isolated from the rest of the ecosystem. And so we were quite worried about that, because if we ran Cape as a smart contract on Ethereum, then people could use it in any DeFi protocol, et cetera. Whereas if you deployed it on a layer two, whether it was an app chain or on top of a specific layer two, we would have to make a choice about, you know, which subset of applications we were integrating with, and it would feel a lot more like we're deploying on a specific layer two ecosystem rather than on Ethereum. And so that's actually what kickstarted this whole thinking about how do we increase interoperability between layer twos on top of Ethereum. And that's what ultimately led us down to completely repurposing a lot of the infrastructure that we were building to actually facilitate an interoperability layer for layer twos. And that's what brought us to shared sequencing.
For me, it was like, I think the Espresso project and team, like that was the first time I even heard of the concept of shared sequencers. Was it your idea, or was there some work happening anywhere else in the ecosystem that you were kind of like drawing on?
It was our idea, at least independently. We came up with this idea after Bogota. So it was DEF CON in Bogota. And we were talking to a lot of teams there, and that's where we came up with the idea. Huh. But I think that there were, you know, other teams talking about this too. We ultimately realized that, you know, teams like Optimism with the Superchain were also using similar language to describe shared sequencing. Around the time that we actually announced the new direction, it was in March 2022, I think.
Must have been 23, because you were on the show in 22. Yeah.
Yes, no, it was March 2023. It was not this past March, but the March before. Wow, I can't believe how time flies. So it was March 23, and at that time, Astria also started talking about shared sequencing already as well.
Okay.
And Flashbots with Suave also was using similar language to describe what is a little bit different from what we're doing with shared sequencing, but the term shared sequencing was certainly floating around. And that's actually, to some degree, what led to a little bit of confusion around the term, because people were using it in different ways to describe different things.
So why don't we kind of define how you see shared sequencers, or like how the term is now used?
Yes.
And basically what you guys are building.
Well, the way that I see it, a shared sequencer describes a ephemeral role of some server, node, whatever we want to call it, that for a given time window determines or proposes the next sequence of transactions for two different chains. So that's what I call a shared sequencer for two different chains. This doesn't need to be a fixed role. It doesn't mean that there's one party that or protocol that's always producing the next sequence of transactions for these two different chains, but simply that there's one party that's playing what we would generally call the role of a leader in a consensus protocol. And so that's also different from the process of actually finalizing or agreeing on what was proposed. That is what I call a shared finality gadget or a consensus protocol. I use the term shared sequencer specifically to describe the role of a leader that gets to actually, you know, have autonomy over proposing during a certain time window for multiple chains at once.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I didn't understand when like the discussion around shared sequencing first emerged was like that privilege to have a proposer that's shared between multiple rollups. It's, you know, revocable. Like it doesn't need to, like you're not sort of like as a rollup like perpetually giving up sequencing rights to a proposer. This is like something that exists for a discrete period of time, and then.
Yes.
I think like, yeah, so I'll leave it at that.
And it's a lot more like the interaction between proposers and builders on Ethereum, whereas the relationship between a builder and a proposer is a little bit different, because the proposer ultimately has the right to propose whatever it wants for Ethereum, and there's this out-of-band, a fair exchange protocol that's happening between a builder and a proposer, and maybe it's facilitated by a relay that is not part of the, you know, the core infrastructure of Ethereum. But a proposer will, at the very last minute, basically auction off the, you know, the block, and is essentially looking for suggestions from a builder market, and make some kind of credible commitment to builders that whatever they propose, it will actually respect. You know, the shared sequencer idea is to auction off the rights to actually be the proposer in the first place. And if you have some party that ends up with the right to be the proposer for multiple chains for a given period of time, that party can then do things, you know, an individual proposer for a chain might not be able to do.
Wow, this is so, like, I've been actually wondering about the connection between MEV and shared sequencers, because I mean, I think I saw you guys at this event focused on MEV and you were speaking there. And I, like, this is really helpful actually to see where it's really tapping into kind of that space. Before we dive even deeper into this, though, I realized that we should probably define what is sequencing today. Mm-hmm. What is the current landscape? How is this currently being done? Because then I think we'll understand even better what this change looks like.
The sequencer in layer two is today mostly a centralized node that plays several different roles. It collects transactions. Those transactions in most rollups aren't posted immediately to Ethereum. This helps with compression. So it collects transactions and builds up a buffer of transactions.
Ah.
And so it's acting as a temporary DA layer, in fact, because it's persisting those transactions. It's persisting the data before it's ultimately posted to Ethereum. And it then compresses those transactions. Either if it's a ZK proof system, sometimes the sequencer role is sort of combined with the prover role, but those are logically separate. So it could outsource the job of constructing a proof to a prover. And at some point it then posts the transaction data to Ethereum compressed. Usually that's before the proof is posted, if it's a ZK rollup. And the second role that it does, in addition to persisting this transaction data, is it acts as, well, first of all, it gets to determine the order in which these transactions actually appear by virtue of, you know, playing that role.
Yeah.
It, of course, may outsource that job to a builder market. That doesn't happen so much today on layer twos, but it totally could. And finally, the last thing that it does is it acts as a certain, you know, trusted finality gadget for the rollup pre-Ethereum finality. So this is sometimes called pre-confirmations or soft confirmations. If you, as a user, trust the sequencer for your rollup, then once you send your transaction to the sequencer, you can, you know, feel like your transaction is done and confirmed, and you don't have to wait for Ethereum to finalize the transaction, which would be another, you know, 13 minutes conservatively, nor do you necessarily have to wait for a proof to appear on Ethereum if you trust the sequencer for the L2.
Who runs the sequencer today?
Generally speaking, the foundations or projects behind various L2s have some default sequencer. I think every project out there has a, you know, long-term plan to decentralize that, whether through external infrastructure or infrastructure that they're building in-house. But typically it's run by the foundation or by the company behind the project. There are also rollup as a service companies that, well, this is more relevant not for the main chains of the various, you know, L2 stacks, but rather the app chains of those stacks. There are companies like Conduit that actually run sequencers for projects.
Hmm. When you talk about like running this sequencer, a centralized sequencer, is it on one machine? Are they also decentralized? Like, is it at least redundant or something? I'm assuming
this
so.
This is it, yeah. I like this question because I think it touches on something about decentralization that is often glossed over. You know, we think of Web2 as centralized infrastructure, but Web2 infrastructure is still very much distributed. It's just the term that we use there is distributed rather than decentralized.
Yes.
And the reason is that usually for decentralization, it's more of a distinction between who's logically participating. If you know, Google were to run a fault-tolerant distributed system on 1,000 machines, we wouldn't call that a decentralized system. Decentralization is, you know, connected to more of a permissionless concept, but even in a permission system, any permission blockchain is going out and trying to find, you know, many different entities that are contributing And those entities are logically separated. They're run by different organizations, different people. And that's what distinguishes decentralized systems from just a fault-tolerant distributed system. If you're going to run a centralized sequencer, of course, you know, the state-of-the-art thing to do is to run some kind of fault-tolerant distributed system.
I think that's a really important point, because I think that people mistake the fact that you can have something that's like fault-tolerant and has like very, very high uptime and reliability guarantees without it being decentralized. And like decentralization, at least in my mind, is much more about avoiding rent seeking and like sort of creating a market structure where you don't have the possibility of capture by a single entity. But I think that mistake gets made a lot when people talk about sequencers.
I want to also understand sort of the economics of the sequencer. Like fees are somehow being incurred by the sequencers. I understand it. But what are those? Are they from the protocol? Or are they actually like gas? Like, where are they coming from?
Great question. So today, when we talk about sequencer, you know, revenue, so to say, it encapsulates a lot of different types of revenue streams that will ultimately be separated when we move away from single, you know, sequencers or centralized sequencers. So the first stream of revenue for a roll-up ecosystem is the gas fees that are being paid, but those are being paid inside the protocol. Today, that might be encoded as a payment to an address that happens to be owned by the same entity that's running the sequencer, but there's no fundamental reason why that needs to be the case. So even if we, you know, were to do away with a sequencer run by the foundation of a roll-up ecosystem, and this was a more distributed or outsourced role, the primary source of revenue for the rollup, which is the gas fees being paid, those are being logically paid as a part of every transaction inside the rollup. And it could go to, you could go to a DAO address, it could be burned, it could be distributed to token holders in that rollup ecosystem. It could go to an address that is controlled by the foundation and then used for whatever the foundation might use it for. I mean, some communities are excited about talking about, you know, public goods funding. Others are talking about it in a different way. Whatever is the case, the sequencing revenue that's generated, or the execution revenue, so the execution fees, are, in my view, separate from any additional revenue that comes from the right to sequence itself.
Because of the way that's set up, like, is there a motivation for these entities that are running this sequencer to actually give that to a more decentralized pot? Like, is there any motivation for them to switch?
Right. So what I was just saying is that the fees that are coming from the gas fees that are being paid, that's going to, if a rollup were to outsource sequencing somewhere else, it would still collect the revenue from, you know, gas fees. So then we come to the next question, which is, well, what additional revenue does a sequencer and only a sequencer make? And that has entirely to do with what is colloquially called MEV, right? So anything that goes beyond the execution fees, the gas fees that people are paying, any other revenue stream is generally, you know, thrown under this umbrella term MEV. Mm-hmm. And that could be, you know, from people paying priority fees to order their transactions in a certain way. It could be from selling, it's a special case of that. It could be from selling arbitrage opportunities. It could also be for things that people don't classically associate with MEV, but is really under the term MEV, which is any form of pre-confirmation. So if a sequencer says to a user, you know, the next time that I have the opportunity to sequence, I promise you that I'll do this for you. You know, the user won't pay for failed transactions. It could be promising that the user, if this sequencer controls multiple chains, it could be promising that the sequencer will try to do some kind of atomic interaction across multiple chains. Let's say the user wants to attempt to do a bridge transaction to buy an NFT, but doesn't want to do anything unless it actually successfully purchases the NFT. That's another type of promise it could make. All these promises, you know, users may pay tips for, and that again becomes additional revenue that's outside of just the gas fee that are being paid, and that is all under sequencing, you know, intrinsic sequencing revenue. So then you ask, if the rollup ecosystems are running their own sequencers today, and this additional revenue could be quite significant, why would they give it away? And I don't think they would give it away, which is why Espresso is building a marketplace through which they can sell it.
Cool. Okay, so let's come back to the shared sequencer. I think this has been really helpful to understand how it is today. The shared sequencer lives as far as I understand, sort of as this like middle layer kind of between the roll-up and the main chain. Is that correct in thinking of it that way?
It's hard to say. It's hard to put it into, because the roll-up itself is it's a virtual machine, similar to how the EVM is a virtual machine. I mean, some of these roll-ups actually run the EVM, others run special purpose VMs. And the layers that we use to describe things, so layers are generally, used to describe infrastructure that's actually, processing and persisting data, and it's not generally used to describe the VM itself, although application layer is something that we describe on top of Ethereum. So the way that I look at it, the layer two is sort of synonymous with the application layer. It is a very much enriched application layer on top of Ethereum.
Yeah.
And so sequencing is more of a, it's more of a layer on top of Ethereum, or now with base sequencing, it sort of blurs the lines between those. But I would say that it is infrastructure. It is a layer above Ethereum in the cases that it's used today, similar to external DA layers, external DA systems. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a layer in between the L1 and the L2, but I have in the past described it as layer 1.5. I'm sort of going back on that description. I'm not sure it's appropriate.
Okay.
Well, we overload the term layer, right? Because
right.
we use it to refer to things like the DA layer and the execution layer and the application layer.
Right.
And those don't really have like a hierarchical relationship to one another.
Exactly. I think that's a good way to describe it, right?
Yeah. But like the L1 and the L2, we relate those hierarchically because the L2 settles to the L1.
Right.
My understanding is that shared sequencing is much more in the former category, because like there's no like settlement relationship between like L2 to L1.5 to L1.
That's right. It is a layer. It is an infrastructural layer, just like an execution layer or a DA layer, but it's not necessarily hierarchically situated between what we generally refer to as layer one and layer two.
You mentioned that the sequencer in the current state does hold DA in a way. Like it holds that place for, I guess, a shorter period of time. Would a shared sequencer then have some sort of DA component, or are you kind of ignoring that for now, like leaving that to the DA layers?
Yeah, so sort of fundamentally, one of the roles of a sequencer today is to persist data before it gets posted to the L1, right? Now, some sequencers in the future may not operate like that, and they would just ingest data that's already been posted to the L1. But rollups that are looking to take advantage of the ability to compress data, before it's posted to the L1 for DA, and primarily driven by the reason for this is cost, and the fact that Ethereum DA is even post 4844 is still more expensive than what external systems can do. That of course may change, but I do see DA, at least temporary DA, as an important job of a sequencer, and so at Espresso, that is a DA system is a part of our infrastructure. So we do provide a DA system that's very similar in nature to EigenDA.
Okay.
But rollups may choose to use alternative DA systems if they so choose.
The connection to MEV, I know you just described it before, but can you actually cover that again? Because I feel I have a little bit more context now. Yeah. Like the builder proposer, I mean, we've done episodes on this in the past, so like we do have material we can link to and stuff, but it might be good to kind of like revisit that idea and say exactly what they're doing in the case of a shared sequencer.
Yeah. So the builder's job typically is, it comes through a just-in-time auction that the proposers run right before they build a block. And typically at this point, all the information is known, although builders may have private order flow of transactions as well that is not known to the proposer. But typically the job of the builder is to figure out like optimal orderings of transactions. And it does this and whoever is able to bid the most, because by virtue of finding the optimal ordering, they can make the most surplus value, typically wins this builder auction. I mean, that's how it works with proposer-builder separation on Ethereum today.
And this is all on the L1, so this is like on Ethereum proper, right?
Well, that's how it works on the L1.
Okay.
But the same exact thing could happen on the L2 with sequencers.
Okay.
So sequencers propose blocks, and sequencers could, right before they propose a block, use the same type of interaction, right? Run MevBoost or something like that, where they would outsource the job of building this block to a builder market. Now, some sequencers prefer to have a sort of a first come, first serve experience. And so that leaves less room for this kind of interaction. And so that may not actually happen. All of this is related to shared sequencing, but quite different, because with shared sequencing, sequencing marketplaces, as I like to call it, the rollups are selling future rights to occupy time slots, right? So they're selling off the right to be the proposer. And the proposer can always, just in time before it actually builds a block during that time slot, it could choose to work with a builder market as well. Whether it could effectively do that or not may be determined by features of that rollup. So rollups that have a very fast block time, it may not leave enough time for a proposer to really outsource that job. Mm-hmm. Rollups that prefer to threshold encrypt transactions and then have some threshold decryption also may not leave as much room for a proposer to outsource that job. There are other ways that, you know, occupying this proposer time slot may bring you additional revenue beyond the gas fees that are being paid in the rollup, which is why I would say that, you know, MEV goes beyond the classical ways in which we think, you know, MEV is generated today in builder auctions. And I gave an example. So one example would be if I'm the proposer for some time slot in the future, I could make a promise to a user that I'll do something when it's my turn. I'll do something like ensure that their transaction goes through. I'll try to do some kind of atomic interaction across different chains for them and ensure that they don't pay for failed transactions unless the whole thing goes through atomically. Those are not typical examples that we give with proposers and builders on Ethereum today because it doesn't, you know, make as much sense. But it is something that would be potentially a significant stream of revenue for shared sequencers that are sequencing from multiple chains on top of the L1.
And when you say multiple chains, these are multiple L2s.
Multiple rollups, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Ben, do you think it's fair to say that like PBS, especially for rollups, allows us to kind of like have our cake and eat it too, and in the sense that we can have like a decentralized like proposer selection mechanism and decentralized consensus where hardware requirements are very low, but builders actually can be like heavily centralized. They can be extremely sophisticated actors that are able to run execution clients across a bunch of different rollups. Is that like a fair characterization of the relationship?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization. I would break it down one more step, which is that you can first determine who is going to actually act as the leader in. So any type of decentralization ends up looking like a consensus protocol. And in consensus protocols, there may be, you know, thousands of nodes participating, but at any given time, there's some node that actually has the job of proposing the list of transactions. Mm. This is called the leader. In Ethereum L1, we just rotate randomly among the nodes participating, and that's how we determine a leader. That may not be the best way to determine a leader, because if you just select a random node to be the leader, that node may, you know, not be very powerful. And that's why proposer builder separation is so important on Ethereum today, because these weak nodes end up outsourcing the job to much more sophisticated actors of actually proposing the list of transactions. The idea here is to say, let's not select a leader at random. We have other mechanisms for achieving censorship resistance and neutrality, which is the main reason to select a leader at random. But let's actually involve some kind of market mechanism in determining who's going to be the leader. It could be an auction. It could be a lottery. We're actually running it as a lottery. The Ethereum Foundation is exploring similar ideas with execution tickets. So we may actually see the L1 transition in this direction as well sometime in the future. And so this ensures that you keep the node requirements very low for like the 12,000 or more nodes that are participating and contributing to security. The nodes that actually end up acting as leaders are more sophisticated actors that have acquired that right through some kind of auction mechanism. They may still choose at the very last minute to re-auction that right to builders, because the sophistication that's required to act as a leader, to act as a just-in-time builder, may be different, right? Mm. But, you know, with that additional sort of color, I do agree, though, with your characterization, Brendan.
I think it raises a really interesting point, because so the builder ecosystem, like participating as a builder is permissionless, right? Mm-hmm. So anyone can like join and start building and submitting blocks. And if they're able to do so competitively, then they can make money. And I think, like, from conversations with others in the roll-up ecosystem, there's sort of like maybe a discomfort with this, because people look at the builder ecosystem and they say, well, like, there might be thousands of nodes that are providing security for the L1, but there are like fairly few builders. And so, you know, what are we doing if we end up with this like relatively centralized builder ecosystem? But it sort of misses the point, because like we need a lot of nodes at the L1 for security, like exactly as you said. So so it's really important to have like a very diverse set of nodes. But if we have permissionlessness at the builder level, and builders are able to give us like really, really good UX, especially, I'm sure we'll talk later about cross rollup transactions and atomicity and these like really cool guarantees that we're able to get from builders. Given, as you said, that we have censorship resistance like elsewhere in the protocol, do you think that it's necessarily a problem if we have like relatively few, like I guess put another way, do we need 1,000 builders that are like actively participating at any one time? Or is it fine to have like still a diverse set of builders, but like sort of a much smaller set than the total number of nodes that are providing consensus security on L1?
Yeah, I think the latter. I tend to look at this problem by looking at what are we trying to solve for. I don't see decentralization as the end goal. Decentralization is a means to some other set of goals. And you know, one of those is higher security, making sure that once things are finalized, they can't be unfinalized, or you know, it would require the mass collusion of many, many actors and a lot of economic value that would be lost to do so, right? So that's the security piece. Then there are other goals like avoiding you know, censorship, or you know, making things as credibly neutral as possible, and you know, anti-monopolization, so trying to make sure that prices remain low. And those can be achieved even if we have only a few builders participating, but they're sufficiently competitive with each other, and if we have additional mechanisms for achieving, you know, censorship resistance. So one thing that you might consider is, well, there doesn't necessarily need to be one proposer. You could have one randomly elected proposer that's in charge for just making sure that certain things get included, and then other proposers that are actually in charge of, you know, how things get ordered.
I want to understand, though, and when you talk about the proposers and the builders, those are outside of the shared sequencer, like, itself, right? Or are they?
A shared sequencer is a proposer.
Oh, it is a proposer. Okay.
It's a proposer. Yeah. So the role of sequencers today in rollups is to act as a proposer, it's to act as a temporary DA system, and it's to act as a temporary finality gadget. So when we move towards this world of you know, more decentralized open sequencing, those roles get separated. And the shared sequencer is specifically a node that ends up proposing, acting as a leader for multiple rollups at once.
Okay.
And rollups can sell this time slot, right? So a rollup could provide a default proposer that will act as the sequencer for that rollup, or it can sell this right, you know, for future time slots using some open market mechanism. And that market mechanism is what Espresso is building.
Interesting. This actually follows, there's another question that I had going back to your, like, the leader creating the list of transactions. I sort of wondered, like, the L2 rollup itself has a list of transactions. But then if you're shared sequencing, you actually have these lists from different rollups.
Right.
When you push them through, when they go through the shared sequencer, does it stay, is it like you assign one proposer to do one rollup's transactions, or is there any sort of mixing?
So first of all, we don't assign anything.
Okay.
But when many rollups participate in an open market mechanism for, you know, selling time slots to propose,
yeah,
then organically, we predict that we will end up in a situation where there are a few proposers that are acting as simultaneously as proposers for multiple chains. And the reason is that if you are the proposer for two chains at once, two rollups at once, you can create some surplus value. And that's going to make, put you in a better position to win the right, because you'll be able to pay more than other people will for that right. So something that we haven't touched on yet is actually, so I've given examples of you know, facilitating atomic interaction. So I think it would be great to get into this conversation because we have Brendan here, but AgLayer, so AgLayer is a great example of this because it is something that enables, you know, fast message passing between rollups that are ZK enabled. And yet there needs to be some coordinator that's actually constructing the blocks for the two rollups and proposing these blocks at the same time and coordinating the message passing. And while that could be, you know, done asynchronously, you know, there's a lot of advantages to having some nodes synchronously build the two blocks at the same time and pass these messages between them, giving them the feel as being part of one chain, at least for a time slot. So the opportunity to play that role is yet another reason to bid for the right to be the sequencer for several rollups at once.
Yeah, I think this is like a really interesting point. And I really like the way that you framed it, where like if you're a single sequencer for a single rollup, no matter like how sophisticated you are, no matter how good you are at building blocks, you will only be able to capture a certain amount of value, and it will necessarily be less than someone that's able to propose blocks across multiple rollups, because for users, there will always be surplus value that's gained by the ability to do things across chains and to do ARBs. And like, I mean, even from a UX perspective, like users will have a better experience if they're able to interact across multiple chains. And so I think like for me, when I first heard the shared sequencing concept and didn't really get it, it was difficult, but it clicked when I sort of like grasped this, that like what you're fundamentally doing is like achieving surplus value for users.
Interesting.
That wasn't really like a question, but I don't know. Is that like the right way to look at it? Or
no, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
In that example, Ben, where you had the proposer actually like having two lists, I'm assuming that they stay as like a concrete thing. What I'm trying to figure out is like, could you have individual transactions on different rollups being mixed together in that list? Like I envision rollup, list of transactions, sequencer proposes that list to the main chain. I don't actually know what that looks like. So maybe I'm mixing it up because I think of it as like a list that's compressed and then written on chain. But if you have two lists, could you like mix those lists of things and then write them to chain?
Yeah. So think about like two different applications on Ethereum. Think about Uniswap and I don't know, think about Aave or something. Okay. Then like there's a list of transactions that are affecting the state of Uniswap. There's a list of transactions that are affecting the state of Aave. If these were L2s, which are just applications, super applications that may host other applications, they still have like independent lists. And there's no advantage of like interleaving those lists. But on the other hand, if what's happening is like a user does a deposit into Uniswap and then takes something out of Uniswap and then does some action and you know gets a loan from Aave or something like that, then there is something that's happening on a level beyond just independently Aave and Uniswap that have to do with what's happening, you know, on the two of them together and then on the L1 as well. So it's not that these like transactions for the different rollups are being interleaved, but what's actually happening on, you know, one or the other, I can make sure that something happens here and something happens here.
At the same time, kind of.
Yeah.
But, and this like isn't really practical if those two rollups don't share a builder for that time slot. I guess to go back into like the historical sharding literature, part of what didn't work was like if you have two shards or two distinct execution environments, like you could create a system where like you're taking a lock like part of a state on one shard and then you're like, you know, submitting that in a decentralized way to the consensus set of another shard. And it turns out that like my understanding is that this is actually very, very expensive because like locking that state, it's risky because you're not able to accept transactions or like confirm transactions for a certain period of time. And I think that if you want to do synchronous composability, like Ben, do you think that in my mind, sharing a builder is really the only way to do that in a practical way? Is that like a fair characterization?
For synchronous composability, yes, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, even from an asynchronous perspective, just making interactions happen faster or making sure that things are atomic, which isn't quite synchronous composability, but just ensuring atomicity of actions across two different rollups, and having a shared, not even shared builder, but like a shared proposer that can pass on those requirements and restrictions to whoever is involved in building the block is important. I think it might be helpful, Anna. So with this question about the two lists, it might be helpful to talk about like an example. Imagine that you had, you know, USDC deployed to both of these rollups. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so USDC has something called cross-chain transfer protocol, where if you burn USDC in a contract on, you know, one chain, then you can mint USDC natively on the other chain.
Oh, cool.
And so this is a great example of a bridge. But so imagine if there's a, you know, the blocks on these two different rollups are being constructed at the same time.
Yeah.
So if you were to also have something like AgLayer, which allows for, you know, message passing between chains so that a chain on one side can verify that something happened on the other side as well, then now you still have an independent list of transactions for this chain one. I'm calling joined chains and rollups using synonymously because, you know, even though it's an imprecise term, that's okay. What the industry uses. So this chain one, it has a list of transactions. There's some, you know, USDC burn transactions along with other things that are being done. Now there's this chain two that also has its own independent list of transactions, including a USDC mint transaction. But this USDC mint transaction is happening, you know, at the same time in the same time period as this USDC burn transaction. And it's only valid because of the fact that this burn transaction happened on the other chain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's receiving some evidence on the side that this, it's aware that this burn transaction happened on chain one. These transaction lists are still independent, right? They don't need to be, there's no advantage of mixing them together and like, you know, compressing them together or anything like that. But the fact that they're happening at the same time and that this chain two is sort of aware that something happened on chain one, namely that the USDC was burned and therefore this mint transaction is valid. That's the point here. And the shared, you know, proposer that we're calling shared sequencer is what is enabling all this to happen at the same time.
Interesting. We've now mentioned the ag layer a couple times. Maybe we should define what that is. Brandon, maybe you can take the lead on that one.
Yeah, so I would call it a decentralized protocol that provides cryptographic guarantees of safety for the type of cross-chain interaction that Ben's describing. And it also allows chains to share, to safely share a native bridge. So if you have two chains that share a proposer and they're doing a bunch of stuff that's happening cross-chain, you can think about just like moving native L1 native assets or L2 native assets seamlessly between those chains, mm-hmm. instead of having to like mint a wrapped synthetic and then swap back into the native representation of that asset.
So
yeah,
with the ag layer, would you call it like a settlement kind of cross-chain thing? Like you're actually moving tokens?
No, the problem which Ben alluded to earlier is that if you want to do things cross-chain and you want to route those cross-chain interactions through Ethereum, then you have to wait for Ethereum to finalize.
Okay.
And so that takes a long time. It's like 12 to 19 minutes to finalize blocks on Ethereum. And so part of the motivation with the ag layer is like, okay, we're not going to wait for that. It's, mm-hmm. it's just totally impractical from a UX perspective. So given that we want to do things across chains in a much, much lower latency way, like how do we do that safely? And how do we guarantee that chains like can't settle to Ethereum with inconsistent state,
mm-hmm.
or like chains can't rug each other on the native bridge, or like even an unsound prover on one chain can't drain the shared bridge of funds. That's sort of the motivation. But as Ben said, it's like, it's not a shared sequencer. It's not a coordination layer or coordination infrastructure protocol. And so it can only work in conjunction with chains coordinating via shared sequencers I think shared sequencers are probably like the best candidate for making this kind of vision work in a very good UX way.
Cool. When I first heard about it, I actually thought it was competition. I thought it was like the Polygon shared sequencer proposal, but it's quite different. It's like a different layer, it sounds like.
Yeah. So I think at like various iterations, like it might have seemed more like a shared sequencer, but it was sort of like liberating, I think, in like conversations with Ben and with Justin Drake to like understand where the concept for shared sequencing was, and like to understand that we actually had zero interest in like building or like competing with shared sequencers. And in fact, it was like much, much better that Polygon was not a shared sequencer.
Mm.
And the realization that it could be like fully complementary with kind of the vision for Espresso and for shared sequencing in general was, I think, a really powerful thing.
Are some of the other networks like ZK-Sync or Optimism, like, are they looking to build their own kind of shared sequencers? Because in a way, they have now lots of rollups built on their stack that will need to kind of interact. And they currently, I guess, all have these centralized sequencers. Do you know of any work there? I mean, I know, Ben, you'd probably recommend they use the Espresso shared sequencer instead, but are they sometimes thinking of building their own that sort of like really just caters to their ecosystem or federation, as we've been referring to it?
Yeah, on the contrary, and I actually don't view what Espresso is doing as at all competitive with what ZK-Sync or Optimism might be doing within their own ecosystems. And this sort of comes back to the understanding of Espresso as a marketplace. So if you view Espresso as a marketplace, then clusters may form where certain rollups always choose to be sequenced together, right? So the idea of a marketplace where everyone has their own, you know, sovereignty to sell their sequencing rights, that may be on a level outside of rollup ecosystems, but rollup ecosystems like the Optimism superchain may not necessarily have individual chains within the superchain selling independently their sequencing rights through a market mechanism like Espresso. But the superchain as a whole could participate. Of course,
could use it,
and so there's value in sort of imposing infrastructure on a marketplace where you're not allowing like every individual, you know, free for all, like sell your, because there's advantages to making sure that, you know, to having the confidence that you'll always be sequenced together, right? And that's the way that I view things like the superchain or hyperchains. Although, to be honest, I really can't tell you because I don't know specifically what the superchain is going to do or hyperchains are going to do. These are sort of more concepts that are, you know, described at a high level right now, but I don't think there's a ton of concrete detail on them yet. What I can say is that if the superchain were to be a collection of rollups that are all being sequenced together, then it could still participate as a unit in a marketplace mechanism like Espresso.
Interesting.
Ben, can I ask a spicier question?
Yeah.
So given what we were discussing earlier around sort of surplus value in shared sequencing, mm-hmm. and in particular, I think like network effects that will grow among ecosystems that can interoperate mm-hmm. and that can share proposers and can share builders, do you think that there will be this dynamic where if you're using a shared sequencer, you will always be able to deliver more value to your users than if you were to not use a shared sequencer? And so it might be the case that, like, you know, fight it, run from it, like shared sequencing will come inevitably or will come all the same. Like, do you think that's like maybe in the end state, like a fair characterization, or is that too spicy?
I don't think it's spicy. I think in general, you know, it's hard to argue with the idea of allowing yourself to participate in a marketplace, right? I think that the vision of this as a marketplace sort of highlights this, that, okay, the market will determine whether this is valuable or not. If you are a rollup, why wouldn't you integrate with a marketplace where you have the option to sell the rights to sequence for your rollups to third parties if they're able to clear whatever price you set? And in this, and this applies to, you know, even superchains as well. Like, why wouldn't the superchain as a whole sell? I mean, my understanding as well from superchain is it's not necessarily a shared sequencer in the sense that there's one sequencer for the whole superchain. And we can make this more general since like it's not specific to Optimism. I think it's a general paradigm. A lot of rollup ecosystems may want to have some form of a superchain as a meta concept. And that doesn't necessarily look like having one sequencer. It's actually a nice selling point to say to rollups within your ecosystem that they can have their own sequencers and that they can have their own sovereignty over block space, over sequencing rights, and they can participate individually in external mechanisms like Espresso if they so choose. The superchain may be something more about, you know, some kind of shared bridge infrastructure or something else that facilitates greater unity among chains within that ecosystem. So anyway, sorry, that's not the most direct answer to your somewhat spicy question, Brendan, but I think that the to summarize, looking at this as an open market mechanism that chains can decide to participate in, it very much highlights the fact that if it's valuable, then it's inevitable, right? There's no downside to integrating an open market mechanism. it only expands your opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, especially, I'm not sure if you've mentioned it explicitly, but like there's an implied reserve set for every like auction from every mm-hmm. Roll-up for its proposer rights, which is like the value that
right.
that roll-up would gain from just, you know,
yes.
sequencing transactions itself. And so like literally it's very difficult to find yes. A downside in that.
I really like talking about these different layers and how they're interacting, ag layer, these hyperchains. But I know Ethereum itself is doing something around sequencers. And I think it's called this based sequencer concept. Can you explain what that is and how Espresso would work with that?
Yes. So Ethereum itself is not doing anything.
Okay.
But is based sequencing is this idea that the Ethereum L1 can function as a shared sequencer. So maybe let me first describe the original version of base sequencing, which was actually the original concept of rollups, like in the original ideas that were described, which was that there's no external sequencer. You just use a smart contract on the L1 to implement some kind of inbox that collects transactions, but doesn't execute them, right? And then periodically, the nodes that are on the layer two, whether it's optimistic or ZK, we'll execute the transactions that are in the inbox and we'll sort of post the result of what the state is. And if it's a ZK rollup, it will be a proof. That is the original concept of a rollup. There's no external sequencers. External sequencers were introduced for various advantages. One being the ability to compress data before it gets posted to the L1. Another being, you know, soft finality confirmation. So if you trust the external sequencer, then it can give you a confirmation about what the state is before it's actually finalized on Ethereum. And Justin Drake sort of resurfaced the idea of base sequencing after people started talking about shared sequencing and was pointing out, well, the original concept of rollups actually had Ethereum as a shared sequencer implicitly. So we could move back to that if there are advantages to shared sequencing. The problem is that people have gotten very, you know, accustomed to these advantages that external sequencers have, data compression, you know, faster finality. So the idea of base sequencing has sort of evolved to look a little bit less like base sequencing was originally described, where it's more about, and what I love about this is that it's focusing on what is the core advantage of involving Ethereum? Well, the core advantage of involving Ethereum is that the proposers that are building blocks for Ethereum can also act as the proposers for layer two chains, right? Well, that's possible without just completely giving away the right to L1 proposers, which has all kinds of downsides, like leaking sequencing revenue to the L1 and not capturing it at the L2, which most rollups I think are sort of uncomfortable with. And the realization is that, well, market mechanisms like Espresso actually capture this too, because they allow rollups to sell sequencing rights to L1 proposers. L1 proposers can participate in this market mechanism. If you're going to be the proposer and you find this out about 32 slots in advance on Ethereum, if you're going to be the proposer for the next Ethereum block, you could also bid for the right to be the proposer for multiple L2 chains at the same time. Now, this becomes particularly advantageous from an economic perspective for rollups that choose to be synchronous with the L1, meaning that their blocks are sort of synchronized with the L1 and they're building off the very latest L1 state. A lot of rollups choose not to do that because it impacts their finality. So some rollups delay any transaction that happens on Ethereum, like a bridge transaction to the rollup, for a long period of time to make sure that transaction on Ethereum is final before it's recognized in the rollup. But rollups that choose to sort of just allow whatever happens on Ethereum to immediately be recognized in the rollup, they, by selling the right to be the sequencer to L1 proposers, will now get sort of a greater synchronous interoperability with the L1. And that's the concept of base sequencing. It has some caveats, but it has some, you know, clear economic advantages. And so some rollups may choose to do this.
If you are selling the right through this marketplace, does the proposer who's participating in that, do they have to be running something in the Espresso format? Like, is it just exactly what they're doing right now and they can just participate in this marketplace, or do they have to actually like be running something else to participate?
L1 proposers that decide to sequence for, you know, for layer twos through a mechanism like this, we'll have to run additional software.
Yeah.
In general, that's like a feature rather than a bug, because even with the original concept of base sequencing, if you just have some L1 proposer that is unknowingly sequencing L2 transactions because it's including it in its block, but it's not really aware of it and it's not doing anything to, you know, special to support it, what will end up happening is then those L1 proposers, by virtue of not sort of being sophisticated to what's happening on the L2, will need to outsource, you know, sort of the job of actually figuring out what transactions should be proposed on the L2 to some kind of builder market. And so you kind of push the problem there. Otherwise, you will sort of miss out on a lot of the, you know, advantages of, you know, what more sophisticated proposers can do for L2s.
Somehow I still don't fully get what the based sequencer is, though.
Based sequencing just means that the proposer for Ethereum is also acting as the proposer for the rollup at the same time.
Okay. Okay, that's that part.
So
I see.
Yeah. So like, rather than some like proposer that's participating in the Espresso marketplace, you're just including the L1 proposer, which is known ahead of time on Ethereum as sort of the proposer that can bid on L2 proposer rights.
Would that be implemented into the L1 in some way? Or isn't that more like the Flashbots team would build this?
No, neither, actually.
Okay.
Vanilla-based sequencing is just, you can use the L1 proposer on Ethereum today, and you give away the right to sequence to the L1 proposer by just implementing some inbox in the smart contract that's running on Ethereum. Right? That's vanilla-based sequencing, or what I like to call original rollup design, right? And the idea that I'm describing here gets back a lot of the advantages that we've gotten, you know, from moving away from original rollup design while still involving the L1 proposer or a L1 proposer that is sophisticated and choosing to participate by allowing the L1 proposer to bid for the right to sequence for rollup. So this would be an L1 proposer that is also running additional software.
Yeah.
Okay, just like MevBoost is additional software, right? So it's also running additional software. And just like proposers choose to participate in MevBoost auctions, they can choose to participate in a rollup sequencer auctions. And they will be in a position to create even more surplus value because of the fact that they are the sequencer for Ethereum. Right? They're the proposer for Ethereum.
Okay,
so now they can do shared sequencing between Ethereum and L2 rollups.
All right. So in this case, the based sequencer, it's a concept.
Concept.
It's like an action. It's not like a product.
It's a concept, and it's a label that could be bestowed upon rollups that make certain choices when deciding how to integrate with a market mechanism like Espresso.
I see. Cool. I have one more question about the list of transactions. This is sort of throwing back to earlier in the episode itself, but I realized as we were speaking that where we kind of left it with the shared sequencer is like, it's a marketplace and you're the proposer. But I've always had this idea of the sequencer as really the thing that makes the list, not that's proposing the list. In the shared sequencer model, is the proposer creating that list as well? Or is it relying on some other agent that's actually putting together the list and then bidding to propose it?
Proposers are making a list. Whether they choose to outsource that job to builders or not is sort of their own prerogative. But proposers are making a list, and unless something goes horribly wrong, that list will be finalized.
I'm talking about the list of transactions on the L2.
I am too.
Oh, you are too. Okay.
So the reason why we're using these terms proposer, right, is to highlight the fact that what a sequencer does is really the job of a proposer within a consensus protocol.
Okay.
So we're unifying sort of the terminology that's used on Ethereum L1 with the terminology that's been introduced by the Ethereum L2. And so when we look at decentralized sequencing or more open market mechanisms for sort of giving sequencing rights, then we highlight the separation between what is finalizing the list of transactions on the L2, which is some form of shared finality. And Ethereum provides that shared finality ultimately. from the act of actually proposing what is the list of transactions to be executed on the L2. That's a job that that sequencers play today, but that could be opened up through a market mechanism to involve other proposers. Yes.
I see. The entire flow, though, because you talk about the proposers kind of on both sides, like on the L1 and the L2, is it almost like proposer on the rollup, builder on the rollup, shared sequencer, proposer, builder?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I regret that maybe I used the terms proposers and sequencers are the same thing. I sort of regret the fact that I introduced this additional term. I think what's causing the confusion is that, so like when I started out, I was saying that basically if the centralized sequencer for a rollup, it's playing several different roles. It's proposing the list of transactions. It's also finalizing the list of transactions based on trust in that.
Yes.
In that centralized sequencer. So it's providing this soft finality.
Yes.
Right. And it's also acting as a DA system. And so the reason why I introduced these separate terms, finality, gadget, proposer, DA separately, is that when we look at opening up this centralized role, then now these three different actions that sequencers do today can be separated. So Espresso as a marketplace is sort of auctioning off the right to be the proposer, but then there's also some form of shared finality that once some shared proposer proposes two lists of transactions for two different chains, then all the other nodes that are participating in the sort of Espresso finality gadget, which is which is sort of a decentralized consensus protocol, and it's being run through Ethereum, that can provide some shared finality. Rollups could choose not to use that shared finality, of course, and just wait for Ethereum finality, or introduce their own mechanisms, whatever may be the case. I just wanted to separate out this action of actually proposing lists of transactions, which is where the shared sequencing is really coming in, versus the act of finalizing and agreeing on what was proposed.
That's really helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for letting me ask that last one.
And we should have asked it earlier, unfortunately.
Yeah. I feel like I've been obsessed with this like list of transactions and who does what to this list of transactions. But yeah, I think that really helps to clarify it. So that wraps up our episode. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming on the show and sharing with us the work that Espresso's been doing on shared sequencing, what exactly a shared sequencer is. This has been so helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. It was really fun being here.
And thanks, Brendan, for co-hosting.
Yeah, of course. Thanks, Anna.
All right. I want to say thank you to the podcast team, Rachel, Henrik, Jonas, and Tanya. And to our listeners, thanks for listening.